Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Sarah LaDuke. Each region of the country has its own distinctive history and culture that sets it apart from others. The capital region of New York is no different. Last month, the Albany Institute of History and Art opened an exhibition celebrating the heritage of this area. The Capital Region in 50 Objects was planned in partnership with the Times Union and will be on view through April 3rd. The Albany Institute of History and Art is just down the street from our studio in Albany. I went there to talk about the exhibition with Chief Curator Doug McCombs and Curator Diane Shuchuk. We began at the beginning.
Well, the idea for this exhibition really developed probably 4 years ago, although we've been actively working on this project for at least 3 years. I think several years ago, the British Museum started off with their all-encompassing History of the World in 100 Objects. We decided to be a little less ambitious than the British Museum and really also decided to focus just on the capital region. We chose 50 objects. So that's sort of the impetus. I think there were other museums and other projects that had similar kind of approaches over the years. The New York Times did kind of a reader poll and also did their History of New York City in 100 Objects. And then more recently, the Connecticut Historical Society did the History of Connecticut in 100 Objects. So it's something that I know a number of other museums and organizations have kind of followed through on over the last several years.
And for the purposes of this exhibition, the Capital Region is where?
We've defined the Capital Region as Albany, Rensselaer, Schenectady, and Saratoga counties. And that was primarily based on readership for the Times Union. We partnered with the Times Union a few years ago to do reader polls, and they sent out 5 reader surveys asking their readership what identified the Capital Region. And their readership they define as those specific 4 counties.
Then tell me more about what people sent in, how it was narrowed down, who else you collaborated with to land on these 50 objects.
Before we actually started the reader poll with the Times Union, we began with a survey that was sent out to about 60 museums and historical societies, other cultural organizations in the region. And that kind of started our search amongst the community as to trying to figure out what really represented the area of the Capital Region. And then again, about a year and a half ago, we partnered with the Times Union, and they did the reader polls for us. And I think combined between the museum survey and the Times Union reader polls, we had several hundred, probably close to 1,000 responses. As you can imagine, trying to winnow all of that down to 50 was not easy. But we had a smaller advisory committee, which was composed of staff, curators from other museums, Paul Grondel, Amy Biancoli from the Times Union, Jack McEnany, and then some academics from the region, all looking at these responses. There was no real ranking system, but trying to figure out, you know, which of these ideas got, you know, more responses than others. And then we also really started looking at the idea of, you know, what topics can best be represented through what objects. So thinking about topics, people, idea, and trying to represent those in objects also, I think, helped us eliminate a number of the topics.
And once you know what you want represented in the show, how do you pursue acquiring these 50 objects?
Well, acquiring the objects was almost as challenging as deciding what topics we were going to discuss.
I can imagine.
But luckily, again, we worked with the community in the sense that we worked with many different museums, libraries, other cultural organizations in the region to borrow materials. And everyone has been wonderful. They've been extremely supportive. And because this really is a community exhibition, it's a way to really highlight our community cultural resources. So we had museums from all 4 counties and also 2 from Schoharie County. I have to mention them, the Iroquois Museum and the Old Stone Fort Museum, because they had material that related to Albany and to the 4 county region. And so we also went over there as well.
Tell us how the show is set up, please.
Eventually, we decided that for all of the 50 topics or stories that we were going to tell, there would be one object, and then there would be one image, which is a large reproduction panel image behind the object, which helps tell the story. It immediately kind of provides context, and it really just helps to work with the object to immediately become recognizable. So in three galleries on our top floor, the third floor of the Institute, we have 50 sections. Each section is one topic that has one object, and most of them have a background image. There are some larger pieces that a background image really wasn't feasible, it wasn't necessary in many cases, and so, you know, we always have an object, but not necessarily a background image.
The Capital Region and 50 Objects will be on view at the Albany Institute of History and Art through April 3rd. I'm speaking with Chief Curator Doug McCombs.
You and I are standing in the sort of intro gallery, and of course, Nipper is here. Could the show have been done without Nipper? Or was he a built-in go-to from sort of the beginning?
You know, almost from the very start, Nipper came up in just about all of the polls. Museum polls, reader survey polls. You know, even though Nipper is a relative newcomer to the region, he was installed on the building on Broadway in the 1950s. So he's relatively recent compared to some of the other topics. He immediately is recognizable as an icon for the city of Albany and really for the capital region. So, you know, the challenge for us was how do you represent, you know, this, you know, this huge dog that weighs several tons that can't be brought into the building, how do you represent that topic, so to speak, in the exhibition? And so here in our intro gallery, Nipper is the only object, he's the only story told, other than the introduction itself. And we were lucky that somebody came to us and said that they had a plaster version that was probably used earlier in the 20th century, a small kind of tabletop size Nipper that is on exhibit here to represent the larger one that's on the roof.
As we enter the second gallery, what should we talk about in here? Diane, let's get you.
Well, I want to also mention that the labels, we actually turned the labels into a collaborative effort and had some of the lending institutions write their own labels, and then Doug and I kind of split up some of the others. We even had an intern help us out. So the labels are even a community-based project, as are all the loans. But in here, I'm a native of the Capital Region, so this is a very nostalgic exhibition for me, because you'll see Vichy water in this gallery, and I drank Vichy water. You see the Hoffman's Playland ticket booth, and I went to Hoffman's as a kid, and whenever you got an A, you got a free ticket to ride at one of the rides. And the Tulip Queen is very prominent in this gallery. So we have the very first Tulip Queen crown ever made when Mayor Corning decided to throw a tulip festival in 1949. He also asked Queen Wilhelmina to name a tulip the official flower for the city of Albany. So she sent a telegram back saying that Orange Wonder was the official tulip for Albany. Then he instituted a festival that was a week long back in 1949. So we have an image of the street scrubbers, women dressed up in the Dutch costumes, scrubbing State Street in back of the actual very first Tulip Queen crown, designed and made here in Albany by the artist Hajo Christoph and assembled by George Righthand. So it's brass and copper with lovely rabbit fur and ermine trim, and the Tulip Queen cape, which has its beautiful crushed like red velvet with rabbit fur collar as well. So this is one of the things you see when you first walk into this gallery.
It's incredibly, as everything will be, we'll try not to overuse the word, but incredibly iconic for the region. And as you said, the Hoffman's Playland booth is here, which is very colorful and fun. It's a very dynamic piece to greet you as you leave the entry gallery. What else should we look at in here? How about the toilet paper?
Well, I think most people will be surprised to learn that rolls of perforated toilet paper were developed here in Albany. We are the birthplace of rolls of toilet paper, yes indeed. In the 1870s, Seth Wheeler of Albany owned a business called APW, Albany Perforated Wrapping. And the company, as the title implies, started off with wrapping paper that was perforated so you could tear off sheets of wrapping paper. And then it didn't take long for him to realize that, okay, in addition to wrapping paper, I can perforate rolls of toilet paper. And lo and behold, not long afterward, he patented perforated rolls of toilet paper. The two that we have here, they're beautifully wrapped in their original wrapping, designed in the 1930s by Heijo Christoph. Heijo is also the designer of the Tulip Queen crown.
I was going to say, that sounds familiar, and I hadn't heard it before a moment ago.
Yeah, Heijo got around. He was quite the designer here in town in the 1930s. And he designed this wrapping cover that's very kind of Art Deco, a beautiful sort of fuchsia color wrapping. So you can only imagine this sitting on the back of maybe a toilet in the 1930s, and it really kind of beckons to you.
Do we have any sense of how many of these wrapped rolls of toilet paper might exist in the world? Probably not very many, because why would many people have saved them?
Well, that's right. We actually had to borrow these from a private collector, Stuart Wagner. Stuart was kind enough to share these with us and with the community. But, you know, I have to say, I have not seen any others. I can't imagine that there are too many rolls, wrapped rolls of toilet paper from the 1930s still surviving.
Isn't that, yeah, it's not the most durable material. And then also, you bought it and used it.
That's right. I think Stuart was a little concerned his kids might have found it and used it, but luckily they hadn't.
Over here, I see a cannon.
We actually have two cannons in the show, and that wasn't planned. It just sort of happened. But the cannon that we're looking at now is a small Dutch cannon made in the Netherlands in the 1630s. And this was a cannon that was brought over with the Van Rensselaer family. Killian Van Rensselaer, a diamond merchant, was given large tracts of land on both sides of the Hudson River in 1629. And the following year, representatives from his family came here and began sort of trying to settle the area. They encouraged colonists to come from the Netherlands. And at some point during that first year or two, this cannon was brought over, probably for protection. We do know that later in life, it was used at the Van Rensselaer house that stood on Broadway, actually right by where Nipper now stands. There was a family house there. And supposedly, even into the 19th century, the cannon was fired to announce the birth of a male heir. Kind of interesting. And what you see behind it is an enlarged version of the Rensselaerwyck map. This was, again, one of the first maps showing the Van Rensselaer lands here in the Albany area on both east and west sides of the river.
The Capital Region in 50 Objects will be on view at the Albany Institute of History and Art through April 3rd. To learn more, visit albanyinstitute.org. Chief Curator Doug McCombs.
Of course, if you talk about Albany and the Capital District of the Capital Region, you have to include William Kennedy, and he came up again in so many of the reader polls. So we went directly to William Kennedy himself and said, you know, we're going to represent you in the exhibition. You know, how should we do that? And he was gracious enough to suggest one of his early typewriters. So what we have in the exhibition is this great black cast iron and metal typewriter, L.C. Smith. And this was made in the 1930s, so it was a little earlier than when Bill Kennedy was using it. But he used this typewriter to type some of his earliest novels, including Ink Truck. And in fact, behind it, we have a manuscript page from one of his novels that he actually typed on that typewriter. And then the image behind it is William Kennedy sitting at his desk sometime in the 1960s with the very typewriter on his desk.
It's a beautiful piece. It's so cool to have it here. What should we talk about next? You pick something, Diane.
What we're looking at now is a knitting machine from the 1890s designed by Clark and Tompkins and manufactured in Troy, New York. So the knitting machines were made in Troy, but they would have been used in mills, either in Cohoes, Johnstown, even in South America or Canada. So these machines, which are huge cast iron machines, this would have knit a tubular cotton stocking-like fabric in two different sizes, and this we chose to represent the textile industry in the entire Capital Region with a backdrop of Cohoes behind it. Because Cohoes, as you know, is called the Spindle City, because at one time it was the largest cotton manufacturing complex in the world in the 1870s, which I didn't know, but I grew up not far from Cohoes, and I didn't really know about that. So I was thrilled to learn about that when I was writing the label for this in particular. So it's quite a grand piece. It has a lot of decorative elements, so it's pretty unto itself. But it's one of the most complicated, technologically advanced knitting machines of the 19th century.
Yeah, it's like any early factory piece of equipment. It's beautiful, it's interesting, it looks perfectly ridiculous, and you don't know how somebody could possibly have come up with it.
Right, but it was, but they did in Troy, so, yep.
Well, one of the most unusual things that came to us through one of our initial polls with the museums was the Witenagemont Oak Peace Tree. Try saying that three times fast. The Knickerbocker Mansion and the Knickerbocker Historical Society submitted this entry, and when we took this to our advisory committee, everyone was astounded. They loved it because I think, first of all, no one had really heard of it before, but it's such an important relic. It's such an important event in our region's history. In 1676, there was a peace meeting or a delegation set up on the grounds of what is now the Knickerbocker Mansion between, or I should say, among three different Native American tribes, the English, represented by Governor Edmund Andros, and then other delegates. And there was the potential for conflict right in that area in the 1670s. And they decided to have this peace meeting to establish some sort of resolution to their troubles. Apparently, Witenagemont is an old English word, which I wasn't aware of, but it actually means a peace delegation and the convening of a peace settlement. At the end of the meeting, when they did come to a resolution and everybody kind of left there happy and content, they planted this tree. It was an oak tree planted in 1676, and it survived for hundreds of years. It finally fell over in 1949 during a flood. And what we have here in the exhibition is a large piece of one of the branches of the peace tree itself. So one of these relics that you'll see here represents something that happened in the 17th century. I think what's also interesting, supposedly according to accounts, before the tree fell over, it was such an enormous tree that the shade of it covered an acre of land.
Wow. This is an audio tour of the Albany Institute of History and Arts exhibition, The Capital Region in 50 Objects. Curator Diane Shuchuk.
So now we're standing in front of another costume, but this time it's a very rare costume that's hardly ever on exhibition, and it's the frock coat worn by Elmer Ellsworth, who was the first casualty of the Civil War. He's pretty well known, but he was born in Malta in 1837, and then he was wounded and died taking a flag down from the Marshall House, and the flag survives in the Military Museum at Saratoga. So he died in 1861, and this frock coat survived in the family. So the family kept the frock coat. It was on view in Albany in 1864 during the Sanitary Relief Bazaar. The ladies had a bazaar here in Albany to raise money for the troops, so this coat was on view then, and then it's been stored at the Military Museum in Saratoga since then, and they've told us that it hasn't been on view in Albany in about 25 years. So it's an iconic piece. It shows the bullet holes, a gray double-breasted frock coat with beautiful brass buttons. Some have been taken by souvenir hunters, but it still retains the bullet hole that killed him, that went through his heart. So this is an incredibly rare thing to have on view. We're thrilled and honored that they lent it to us.
So as many people probably are aware, or maybe not aware, one of the first radio stations to broadcast in the United States came out of the region, actually out of GE. WGY started broadcasting in 1922, and we worked with MySci, the Museum of Science and Innovation in Schenectady, who really has probably the best collection of material related to WGY and early GE. And when we were looking at things from their collection, they showed us this great microphone from the 1920s, the late 1920s. One of the first microphones that would have been used on WGY broadcasts. And the picture behind the microphone shows the Schenectady GE building number 40. And we see the signs, we see the towers broadcasting the radio station from the roof. It's a great image to kind of set the microphone in context.
The sound fidelity of modern microphones is better, but old microphones are so beautiful. That was so cool looking.
We also worked with Vicarious Visions, who is probably the lead producer of video games, and they're located right here in Menands. When we worked with them in the past, they done all kinds of things for us. And so they were really excited about working with us on this particular exhibition project. And what they decided to bring in for us is this wonderful animation figure, kind of super life-size animation figure of a character called Washbuckler from their Skylander Swap Force video game. So we certainly have something here for all ages. I have to admit, I'm probably a little too old to remember the Skylander Swap Force series. I know it's something that's still happening today, but I think for a lot of our younger visitors who come in, this will certainly appeal to them.
Tell me about the anti-rent movement.
Sure. The anti-rent movement. That was certainly a result of the patroonship, the Van Rensselaer patroonship that we talked about a little while ago with the canon coming over in the 1630s. Well, if you fast forward about 200 years into the late 1830s, finally a lot of farmers who were renting property, renting land from the Van Rensselaer family, became a little disgruntled. They never had the opportunity of owning the land. They always were perpetually paying rent to the Van Rensselaers. That was part of the arrangement when the Van Rensselaers got the land in the 1630s. So in the beginning in 1839 and continuing into the 1850s, there was a very distinctive kind of land reform protest movement that started here in the region that's usually referred to as the anti-rent movement. And this was, again, a way to kind of reform the land and allow farmers to be able to buy it outright. When we were trying to figure out how we could represent the anti-rent movement, Jack McEnany, who was on our advisory committee, said, well, you know what, I saw this really great banner out at the Grafton Library. And then we started talking about some other things. So a few days later, I finally decided, I'm going to give them a call. And when I called the Grafton Community Library, they said, oh, certainly, we have this banner. It's been conserved recently. And I eventually took a look at it, and I have to say it's one of the rare survivors of this particular political unrest. It's hand-painted and some stenciling on probably linen sheets. Or cotton sheets, I believe, in this case. It shows a figure dressed as an Indian. He's holding a hatchet in one hand, and in the other hand, he's blowing a tin horn. Many of the anti-rent protesters would dress in calico, they would put feathers on their head, and they would disguise themselves as Indians to kind of avoid being discovered by the sheriffs, who were often coming by to stop their protests. And if they needed help from their fellow anti-renters, they would blow a tin horn. And that was a way to kind of bring others to, again, help protect them from the sheriff. So what we see on this great banner is this figure of this, what they called a calico Indian, and then this phrase, down with the rent. And so it's just a great way to kind of look at social protest and community protest in the 19th century.
Doug McCombs is the chief curator at the Albany Institute of History and Art. We also spoke with curator Diane Shuchuk. The Capital Region in 50 Objects will be on view through April 3rd. To learn more, visit albanyinstitute.org. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.